It's already 8:31, so shall we begin?
We shall begin.
Okay, and thank you, Mel, for putting us out. Okay, now, quickly, before, because I always have a lot to do, all these comments that come into me, I want to first show you something on the screen, because I mention things, and then people ask me, they don't really know what I said, so here. This is last week I mentioned the Hadassah Medical Convoy Massacre. And you can read about it on Wikipedia, in which some 70 some people, 79 it says, were killed. And these were civilians going up to Mount Scopus, including Professor Freiman. That's the first thing I wanted to mention to you. We'll close this out now. We spoke about Deir Yassin last week and different perceptions of it. I'm looking here on the next day, Tuesday, January 5th, 2021's Wall Street Journal. You have letters to the editor about the Blackwater pardons, if you know about the Blackwater pardons. So one of the letters saying it's a disgrace. These are killers who opened fire on a crowd of unarmed men, women, and children. And the very next letter is a defense of it, that these were under great stress. It wasn't intentional. So there's different ways to look at it. Rabbi Mazuz's column last week, spoke about Tunisia carrying on Shabbos. He tells the story. This is on section 10, note 10. When he came to Israel in the early 70s, someone asked him, is it true that in Tunis, not even one person is Mechal Shabbos? And he's like, what are you talking about? Kulam motzi mirshut v'shut. Everyone carries. Kulam etalkali. That's before we had Erevin. Think back to when you were young. How many people really were so medoctic that they didn't carry handkerchiefs or things like this? I mean, think about Sukkot, if it's on Shabbos, how difficult it is if you're not connected. I mean, people, it's hard for us to imagine, but that's what, there weren't any Erevin in these cities. So the average person, they weren't really mockpit on that. And people didn't understand it, really. They felt this was something that the rabbis did. So, but they didn't have to. Okay, now I want to say something before I return to two more things. Okay, this I'm going to, I have to say this. I could have said it another time, but I'll say it now. This takes us back to the very early class, where apparently I made a comment. Well, I did make the comment that I think it's very good that our kids in the modern Orthodox world learn Tulane, and the Haredi world, many of them don't learn Tulane. Not all the Haredi world. In yeshiva circles, Minyanim, they don't let the boys learn at their bar mitzvah, but they're definitely in Haredi Lifshitz circles where they do learn, but in the Hasidic world, they don't. Okay, so someone finds, you know, look, let me just say something. We need to be able to accept criticism or something good, even from the other side. You're never going to convince me that it's not a good thing for the bar mitzvah boys to lane. If you don't lane, half the people never learn to lane. The fact that I'm not in the Haredi world, so what? If you can have your view, but I'm going to have my view. And anyone who's been listening to me knows that I often say that the Haredim do things better than the modern Orthodox. I'm no big defender of the modern Orthodox. Let me give you another example I've never mentioned. I don't like speaking under the chuppah at weddings. The rabbis have enough time to speak. I don't go for that. Maybe if your daughter's getting married, it's one thing. I don't think we need it. I like the Haredi weddings. But why am I mentioning all this? Because someone, maybe there's more, wants to think that this whole idea of the modern Orthodox boys laning for their bar mitzvah is—it's a show. It's trying, you know, it's a modern Orthodox shtick. Like we do other things, like what? Like communal singing. I happen to like communal singing, but I mean, so like this is a modern Orthodox show, and we're Haredi. We go by the Masora. We don't need to. So it's sheker muchak. For if you're listening live, or you're going to listen on the YouTube. Let me read you something here. This comes right from Minhagei of Vermeiza, edited by Rabbi Hamburger. Just so you know, the Minhag Ashkenaz is that bar mitzvah boys lane. It's only recently that in yeshiva circles they stopped laning. What the modern Orthodox are doing, whether they know it or not, is the Masora. If you look in the Minhag of Worms, it says that on the Shabbos, right after you become bar mitzvah, Rov B'nai bar mitzvah are the Chazanim and for Kriyas HaTorah. And it says that, it even says that it's a Chiyuv, to read from the Torah. If you look in, this is on page volume one, page 165. You look in Ram Habberger's note. He says, "Minhag pashut ba'Ashkenaz hayashanara b'mitzvah kara as parshas hashavua kula." The minhag of Ashkenaz was that the bar mitzvah boy read the parsha, rak samoch dorenu, but it's only like within the last generation or two. Hurgulu rabim hakel lehem. The people stopped doing this. But this is minhag Ashkenaz, and he quotes the Ma'aril, the Leket Yoshel, Yosef Omitz, the Magen Avraham. Rav Yarish Chaim Bachrach, the Levush. You can see all the sources here. And then he goes on in the Minhage Vermeiza. He says there are some bar mitzvah boys who have a good voice and they know how to daven mitzibor. They daven at Ma'ariv the night before. They daven Shacharis and Musaf or whatever they can. And then he says there are some who don't even know how to read Torah and they can't read, so they just get the an aliyah. But this idea that this is some modern Orthodox thing to perform before the family, that it was invented, it's complete bogus. This is the minhag of Ashkenaz. Now, Sfardim, I don't know, because the Sfardim, for instance, many Sfardim lay in before the 13. And in Gerba, and it continues in Kiserach and B'nai Brak, every week they review the Parsha together as a group with the truck. So they remember the whole Torah with the truck. So they don't need to be taught. I don't know about other places in the Sephardic world, but this is just to get it off my chest. This is this idea that this is a show put on by the, that's Minhag Ashkenaz, that the bar mitzvah boy will read his parsha, or at least some of it. Ruvain from Paris. He wants to know, we spoke about last class, Talmid Chacham, how it's in the construct, but he says, but if you look in the Gemara in many places, it's clear that they're not using it as a student of the wise, they're just using it as a scholar. Yes. Today, the word Talmud Chacham does not mean student of the wise. If you are an autodidact and you never had a Rebbe and you learned all by yourself, like sort of like the Chazon Ish, Chazon Ish never went to yeshiva. All of his learning was pretty much on his own. Really, all his serious learning was on his own. He's still a Talmud Chacham. The word today means Torah scholar. In fact, if you were translating a text and it says Talmud Chacham, you have to translate it as Torah scholar. If you translate it as student of the wise, that's really, it's an incorrect translation. But it originally goes back. That's where it comes from. You're student of the wise. Ruvain from Paris, and also Rabbi Leib sent me things about Rav Tzadok, who also has the view of the Lubavitcher Rebbe last week, at least originally, of the Rav Shneur Zalman, not to answer questions dealing with mundane things. Although they both also pointed me out to similar things, sources. You can find this also in the journal Hechel Abesh, number 26, where it shows that Rav Shneur Zalman of Ladi, he was prevailed upon by his Chassidim. He didn't want to answer mundane questions. But as put by the Lubavitcher Rebbe Menachem Mendel in Torah Menachem, pages 127 to 128, that although he didn't want to do it, the people pushed it. The people still wanted answers to their everyday questions. So what can you do? If the Hasidim want, you have to give it to them. And one final thing before we return to pick up where we left off. Actually, two more things. I promised Robert I'd get to this. So let me say, remember we spoke about Uber? Uber Eats, is that halachically permissible? Well, in the Jewish link, because you're carrying non-kosher food, from 2 weeks ago, Rabbi Chaim Jachter, he's been on Torah in Motion, he's a rabbi in the shul in Teaneck, and he's written a few svarim. He's an Ashkenazi, of course, rabbi of a Sephardic shul, though. I first met him when the last time the Rav gave his summer kollel, summer of 1985, where I was there. You had a number of, Yair Khan was there, late Rabbi Joshua Hoffman, and Rabbi Jachter. And Rabbi Jachter was the one who drove the Rav back and forth and on a number of occasions, because he needed someone, I went with him. And that's where the questions that I record that I asked the Rav, the famous ones before Nefesh HaRav, I was the one who asked him about Thanksgiving. It came during those trips back and forth. But he has an article in the Jewish link. And he discusses what we did. In fact, he mentions Ramosha Feinstein, that there's no problem at all. Ramosha Feinstein explicitly permits transporting kosher items. He quotes Ravad Yosef as saying that it's permissible, but it's better not to. I don't see where he gets this. I'm looking at Ravad Yosef right now in when he did the Kaf HaChayim that he added the extra pages on. To in Siman Kufyat Zion, Ravad doesn't say that at all. He just says, Nira, Ikar, Kadasamatiri, before all of the kids. So, but then, and then he says there is especially room to be lenient since the Rashba writes that the prohibition to engage in business with non-kosher food is due to concern that one may eat it. However, this concern hardly applies to an Uber Eats driver who jeopardizes his job if he eats the delivered food. So based on this, we conclude there's no problem with Uber Eats. He then later gets into, well, what maybe it's lifnei iver, which I guess could be it. He concludes that you probably shouldn't do it unless you really need the money, because I guess that would apply if you're in a Jewish area. There's, according to some, it's a rabbinic prohibition to give someone something that's they'll violate, let's say they'll eat non-kosher, even if they can get it without you. But what I want to mention here is, because the major point, I think, is he says, despite what I just told you, he says as follows, which is just completely bizarre. After saying the Rashba that you can be lenient because you can't eat the food, you're the driver, you don't own it, you're just transporting it, which Rav Moshe permits or Rav Vadia. He says, nonetheless, I heard that customers occasionally grant permission to the driver to eat some of the provided food. Thus, the Rashba's concern might very well turn out to be relevant to the Uber Eats driver. Now, like I said, this is bizarre. This is completely false. There's never, ever been a case where an Uber Eats driver was told by the person they could eat the food. Quite apart from the fact you don't know that the whole thing of Uber Eats. Now, you don't know who's delivering the food, whoever delivers it. But is there ever such a person who would tell the delivery person, you can have some of my French fries or take a bite of my hamburger when you're delivering it? I guess in theory, if it's a guy who works at the pizza shop and he's your buddy and he's always the one who delivers it, you might say, yeah, you can have a slice. But I mean, this is not, halacha's never decided. We used to, in yeshiva, sometimes we'd ask about these far out cases and they'd always tell us, halacha's not decided by a far out case like this. It's decided by, so yes, if you're at a place and you're working at a non-kosher place and someone calls up and he's your buddy and says, deliver the food and you can have a bite of it, maybe then you couldn't. But the idea, like I said, it's bizarre. There's the idea that, I mean, that an Uber Eats driver is given permission by the customer to start chewing on the food as he's delivering it, never happened. Okay. Let me just say three more minutes before we pick up, because I do have to say something. Many of you commented on last week and the tour. Incidentally, those who are interested, the new edition of the tour got a. If you're interested in the tour, it's like 22 volumes, and it's been out maybe 15 years or so. It divides the Beis Yosef, the tour, very nice, very easy to follow. Okay, what do I want to say before we just 5 more minutes? In response to many questions, I looked into things. I found all sorts of interesting things. Incidentally, I don't know if Baruch's with us, but I found the Chosam Sofer in, he speaks about, you can find this in Mamarim Chadashim on Parshas Vayetze. He wants to know, because he's looking at the Yaakov's wedding to Leah as a halachic marriage. He says, how could it be a halachic marriage? It was Kiddush Etos, because he didn't know who he was marrying, like sort of what I said last week. And he says that when he saw she got pregnant, though, then he didn't want his bilaso to be bilasnus. He didn't want it to be immoral sexual relations. So therefore, ex post facto, he accepted it. And a number of sources, I just looked on Otzer Chachma, a number of people comment on the Bala Turi, and they're all, it's shocking. They're saying that had he not said it, we couldn't have said it. I'm not talking about the hitting her. I'm talking about the idea, hifkira atzma, that, to use that language. And I found Rav Vosner in Sheva Talevi on the Torah, Parshas Vayetze. He also picks up with this. He says, Tamua, how could you say this about Leah? And he develops the idea that that Yaakov, what does it say? First of all, he says, what does it mean that Yaakov hated her? There's different types of hatred. You know, the Gemara, there's Chumash speaks about, if you see the donkey of an animal carrying heavy stuff of the person you hate, and the Gemara says, what does it mean you hate this? You have to help it out. What does it mean hate? It doesn't mean hate like we think of. It means if he did an avera, and therefore you have reason to feel negative. So he develops the idea that Yaakov thought that a negative thing about her. And not that he hated her per se or anything, but he saw a certain pagam in her. But then I want to get back to the question that about the hitting her, which and next week I'll explain this about the what I mentioned, that it was the proof that Yaakov was drunk from the psukim at the wedding, which incidentally, if you look even at traditional commentators, we see them saying it. Hillel Mansfield writes that the word, the root from Aleph Nun Hey, he tries to bring all sorts of examples where it refers to something specific. So when Leah says that God has seen my affliction, you know, Chazal, assuming it's from Chazal, where the Torah, we're looking for something specific. The big thing is that I was trying to figure out last class. I was looking for the Aderis, if you recall, and I couldn't find the Aderis. And it wasn't the Aderis I was looking for. It was actually Rav Aryeh Leib. And Rav Aryeh Leib, who continues, and then I found it even by myself in the Bereishis Rabbah. If you look in Bereishis Rabbah, in Parshas of Vayishlach, right at the beginning, it already speaks about, you know, how, why did, it says Dina went out, and the way she was dressed that led Shechem on, and it's they say that Leah, when she went out to meet meet Yaakov, it's in I'll read you the pasuk here. One second, it's in chapter 30, verse 16. It says, when Yaakov came into the field, Leah went out to meet him. And what does the Midrash say? It's not me saying it. It's the Midrash. The Midrash says she went out to meet him adorned like a harlot, kazona. And you have a number of passages in which, for whatever reason, Leah is portrayed negatively in the commentators and Chazal. We wouldn't say that, but that's how she's portrayed. So the idea that Yaakov thought that she was not behaving properly, and maybe that could explain why the Baal Turim was led to this idea of hitting, or whatever it is, for some reason, Leah is portrayed in a certain negative way. I had lots of other stuff I wanted to say, but I see that the hour's already late, so I could go on and on. I'll get to the idea of the wedding next week. I think you'll find it very interesting how the psukim actually show us something which you wouldn't get on your own. Now, there's a parallelism, the sort of stuff that Rabbi Leibtag would do. I'll do that next class. I also have to apologize to Rabbi Chaim Palachi, because I said last week that he was the one who said that it wasn't him. He opposed the view that sometimes you could hit, but they both could hit that. I mean, if there's a good reason, it's actually someone else. You can see this all in my book on page 208. But look, there's a lot to say. I could spend a whole class on this, but I don't want to, because we have other good stuff today. There's a lot more that came in this week, but I don't feel I need to share it with you. But this I wanted to. Okay. So let's pick up. We're in the Igros Malchei Rabbanon, the Sefer. We're picking up on page 250, which is Siman Kufchaf Beis. And this is another letter to me from Rabbi Shalat, the great Rabbi Shalat, the Rosh Yeshiva of Birkas Moshe in Maale Adumim. As I mentioned before, that there used to be a number of Americans used to go to Maale Adumim. There's someone in my shul who went to Maale Adumim. I haven't, should say Maale Adumim, but I haven't heard recently, at least from my area, and I'm not sure why. It's a top yeshiva, but Rabbi Shalat, I asked him a question. The first thing, we don't need to get into, it's how to understand the passage in the Hakdama of the Rambam to the Mishnah. So he explains it. But then in the PS, he writes to me thanking me for sending him the collected writings of Rabbi Yochai Yaakov Weinberg, actually volume two. I think I sent the volume one already, which is collection of all of Rabbi Weinberg's essays, which hadn't appeared. And he says that the house was full of light, because this is a great collection, and I didn't even know it. He says that his father, who had just passed away, was a student. His name is Greenspan in Germany, of Rabbi Yochai Yaakov Weinberg. And then he says, "Zechus haGaon hanal zatzal," that is, the zchus of Rabbi Chaim of Weinberg, Shahaya Rabbo Shalavi Mari, he was the teacher of my father, Talmud Kvodo Abeta, should, you know, his zchus should be stand for me. I find that unusual because Rabbi Shalat is such a Maimonidean. Oh, first incidentally, he says zchus ta'amod. We usually say Zayin Yud Aleph, Zechuso Ya'amod, because Zechus is the sort of word that in modern Hebrew, it's feminine, but if you look in medieval Hebrew, they use it as masculine. It's one of those words that could go both ways. But if you look at Rabbi Kafach, well, what does that mean, Zechuso Ya'geno? It means that the merit of this deceased person will protect us or, you know, assist us. The Rambam didn't believe this. In the Rambam system, you stand on your own. There's no such thing that someone else's, someone who died, that the mitzvahs that this person did, that his zechus is in your merit. There's no such concept for the Rambam. So if you look at Rabbi Kafich, he never says zechuso yageinu leinu. What he says is, about the Rambam or anyone else, he says zechus limud toraso yageinu leinu. That is, the merit of studying the Torah of this sage will actually, he's not, I don't know if he's 100% consistent, but he does say that. What's the zechus, the merit of studying this Rambam's Torah, that will stand us in good stead. But Rabbi Shalat, who's the greatest Maimonidean scholar of our time, succeeding Rabbi Kafach, he had no problem saying zechus agon tamod lichvodo obeso. Okay, that's that. The next letter, number 123, is to this individual. Let's get you up on the screen here. He passed away at the age of 98 in July of COVID. His name was Shmuel Ashkenazi. He was regarded as, he comes from the Eda Charedis, that, you know, the extreme Haredi community in Jerusalem, but he became, as it says, he began to publish articles when he was young in every major and minor journal and form of Torah scholarship from the age of 18 in 1940 until his death. He became known as the greatest bibliographer in maybe in the world, with his hand on everything. He worked in the Jewish National, well, for a time, I know he worked at the Jewish National Library. He also was hired to give various projects. Today, if you have a question, if you want to know where something appears, what do? You Google it. You go on Otzer HaChochma. You can find everything. What did we do before this? How did you, if you wanted to know who discusses this and who has the answer and where is this found? Yet, there was a few people in the world you could turn to. One of them was Shmuel Ashkenazi. I don't even know where I got his address from, but I started sending him questions. And wait till you see what he replies and the generosity of spirit. And it's not just me. They published the end of last week, three volumes of his letters. He kept track of every letter he ever sent. And the letters we're going to see now are included in there from all the top scholars in the world, because everyone turned to him, religious, non-religious, it didn't matter. So in an era before you could search, and even when you could search, he still was invaluable because he's the sort of person that knew everything about everything. So in we'll see a few letters to him. In Simon Kufchav Gimel, I wrote to him a question, the sort of thing that today I just would go on Otzer Chochma, plug in the words, and I get the answer immediately. But this is taking us way back to the early 1990s. My question was that you sometimes see a reference to a based in Memvav Shin. What does that mean, Memvav Shin? Today, like I said, I've written about it already. You can find what I wrote all about it, but I didn't know what it meant. And how am I supposed to know what it means? It's not like I have an encyclopedia, Memvav Shin. You have to know there was a time when you needed to know which person you could ask. If you had a question about one thing, you asked the question about another thing, you asked the other person. A few well-placed questions. I remember once we were in... in we were studying something from the Ron, Rabbeinu Nissim, and Dr. Professor Bernhard Septimus's class. And in the notes in the Feldman edition, he says either I can't remember if he doesn't give the right explanation or he says I don't know what this means. And Professor Septimus says he didn't understand this comment. I think it was I don't. He says I don't know what the source is, what it means. He says because Professor Septimus knew what it meant, so he said a few well-placed questions. He would have been able to solve that. So when he was preparing the edition of the Ron, okay, you could have asked Shaul Lieberman, you could have asked Professor Tushma. I mean, there are these people who like have everything at their fingertips in this area. So and by the way, these people are still very helpful. Not that I'm at their level, but some of you like to send me emails, so I try to do my best to answer because at least in a couple areas. I have my hands on lots of things, and that's it's all a joint effort. So what we can help each other. So, what does it mean, based in Moshe, Mem Vav Shin? That was my question. And in particular, this was used about the Beis Din of Prague. Prague, the Ir Vayim BeYisrael, as we say, a great Torah center. Well, before I tell you what Mem Vav Shin stands for. Well, actually, let's do that first, and then I'll tell you why this is significant. He explains to me that this is the Beis Din in Prague. The Beis Prague had a major Beis Din and no Rabbi Yehuda. He talks about the history of what this is and how it's unclear what it meant. Everyone knew that the Beis Din in Prague was the Beis Din Moshe, but even Shir, Rosham Yehuda Rappaport, who was the Av Beis Din in the Beis Din Moshe, he didn't know what the word stood for, and people have given all well, the letter stood for. People have given all sorts of suggestions. It actually means Morishava, which seems to mean that that everyone in the Beis Din is equal. But it's the Beis Din of Prague. But what is this Beis Din of Prague? And this is what's so important and significant. This was an appeals court. In Prague, you had different, a couple different, let's say, Batei Din, and then you had the Beis Din Moshe was an appeals court. This is quite significant because if you look in the Gemara, you don't have any example of an appeals court. In fact, the Gemara has an expression that one Beis Din after another Beis Din can't challenge it. You can't second guess it. So, for example, if you decide to go to the RCA Beis Din and the RCA Beis Din rules against you, you can't then go to the Agudas Rabbanim and say, look over this case. And when the chief rabbinate of Eretz Yisrael was organized by the British, there always was a Sephardic chief rabbi called the Rishon LeZion. But when Rav Kook was made the chief rabbi and the British wanted to create the whole system, they insisted on an appeals court because you can't have any modern system of law without an appeals court. They did have it. It is an appeals court. The Beis Din HaGadol in Jerusalem, the official name is a Beis Din HaGadol Irurim. It's an appeals court. And you had people in the Haredi, the Eda Haredis, where Shmuel Ashkenazi comes from, who said that, no, you can't have this. There's no source for this. This is taken from secular law. It's wrong. It's not Torah. And yet it's totally false. Again, it's done. Shmuel Ashkenazi could have told him about this because we have had appeals courts. We had appeals courts in Spain, you had in Portugal, you had in Salonika, you had in Jerusalem, you had it in Moravia, you had it in Prague. So what about this idea that the Beis Din, you can't have appeals court? What does that mean? Well, there's all sorts of explanations as to what it means. Rav Duchovsky from the Beis Din HaGadol has an article about this. Others have articles about this. All it means is that, as I said, if you go to the RCA Beis Din and you don't like it, then you can't go to another Beis Din. But if you have an entire system where you have a court and then it's understood that when you go to the court, there's also a higher court, then there's no problem because when you go to the lower court, you're agreeing implicitly that either party, if there's a problem, they could take it to the appeals court. And the Gedolei Yisrael, every great Torah scholar, other than like in the super Haredi world, Rav Ovadia Yosef, Rav Elyashiv, you go down the list, the greatest Torah scholars, or Jolty, they were all on the Beis Din HaGadol of Jerusalem, which is the appeals court. But this isn't something new. This, and the most famous one is, as I said, in Prague. But if you look at Simcha Asaf, the great Simcha Asaf's book on Batei Din v'Sidreiim, something like that. He has a whole chapter there giving all the evidence for all the different appeals courts that we've had. It seems the earliest are in Spain, and also we have it in Portugal. So That's so that you have the micro and the macro. The micro of the question is the based in Moshe. That's just the technical term that's used, which I didn't know. Bear it in mind if you ever come across it now for the based in of Prague. But what makes it so significant is that it's an appeals court. And that, so for example, the Note of Yehuda, or all it would be, and he mentions it incidentally. And in fact, in the Note of Yehuda, in one place, he even writes in German, he goes, Appellanten, appeals, or Latin, I'm not sure, yeah, Latin, I guess. So that was the highest court. And if you ever create a court system, you can have an appeals court. Now, what do you do today? If you go to the RCA based and you think it's a mistake, I don't think you have any, you have no choice. Because there is no appeal system, and you can't then just decide to go to a different beis din. That's what the Gemara is speaking about when it says beis din after another beis din doesn't challenge it. But so I guess you're out of luck. If you know the famous, I think it was Mordechai Bennett said as follows. He said about batei din. It's interesting. He said if you would go to the rabbi, he's trying to understand something. When you when people come out of a beis din, two people are arguing over a case, and the one side that loses, they come out and they get very angry, and they curse the dayanim. And he asked the question, well, what's going on here? When they, if you bring, let's say, a chicken, or even something much more expensive to the rabbi, and the rabbi examines it, and he can't find a way to permit it, so he tells you, you know, you can't use this, and you end up losing a lot of money. People, at least in those days, they accept the halacha. They don't curse the rabbi out. They understand that's the halacha. So why is it Rav Mordechai Bennett, he was the chief rabbi of Nicholsburg, of Moravia. He was rabbi in Nicholsburg. He says, why is it when people have a case in the Beis Din and the Beis Din rules against them that they end up cursing the Beis Din and get so angry and everything? He says it's because they're not upset that they lost. They all the time they go to the rabbis and they lose money because based on halachic decisions. In this case, they're really upset that the other guy won. That's why they're cursing the rabbis out, because they favored the other person. And if you go to the RCA base and you lose, you can only curse them out, because you can't go to the appeals court. You can't go, you can't take it higher. Now, the function of the appeals court, it's supposed to be if there's issues that weren't raised. I think in Israel, though, it seems to be more of a, you don't really need to show that. You don't need to show it. Rabbi Bleich has a piece on that where he doesn't understand how cases can be brought to the appeals court in Israel just based on the fact that maybe the appeals court will decide halacha differently. Because we, in you know, outside of Israel, you think of an appeals court, if there's a problem that, you know, maybe wasn't determined correctly, or there's other issues of law. But in Israel, it seems to be standard that if you don't like the decision, you can just go to the higher court and they can overrule it based upon their own shita. That's the appeals court. That's number 124. 125, in his letter, he cites a number of examples. And 124 is another letter to Rabbi Ashkenazi. And this takes us back to 1991, a long time ago. I was writing an article, one of my first scholarly articles, not the first one. The first one is also we're going to see soon, on the issue of suicide and the world to come. That's what it's called. It was published in the AJS Review. And I started collecting all these sources because I found something interesting, that the concept, which many people have heard of, that a suicide has no share in the world to come, which you find very common in the Achronim. You don't find it anywhere in the Gemara. You don't find that in the Rishonim. So I wanted to explore, where does this idea come from, that a suicide has no share in the world to come? And I had collected a number of sources on my own. I had seen discussions of it. But I wrote to, I just in case I overlooked things, I wrote to Rabbi Ashkenazi, just a question, you know, a short question on a postcard. He sends me back a very long letter. This is before the internet, before all these databases. And he cites all these sources, beginning with Josephus, and then Yosipon. Yosipon is not Josephus. The Kalila with Dimna, that's this Arabic text, going through Rabachya, Radak. Like Radak doesn't say you have no share in the world to come. It just says you're punished in the world to come. But going on, the Zohar, I mean, the Zohar is interesting because the Zohar says Shimshon doesn't have a share in the world to come because he says Tamus nafshi im plishtim. Let me, I might die with the plishtim. So is that maybe that's an example of, I didn't cite this in my article there, but in numerous other sources, with all these things, both different directions of, and the last one he cites is from Yoshe Shalom Nathanson, that he goes, Shigra Delishna, Shibafiko. He says, everyone has this idea that, there's no share in the world to come. So that's just the various sources you can see in my article. He called attention to one thing in particular that I cite. I'm not sure what the Zohar means. It would be strange if the it could be. I think probably what the Zohar means there is that Shimshon didn't have faith. That's why, and he decided to kill himself when he shouldn't have. Not that per se, the idea of a suicide, because we have all these other examples where they say on the contrary, a suicide, you can pray for a suicide. A suicide does have the world to come. So I don't know. When I do my collected essays one day and I put them all together, I'll revisit these passages. Some people say explicitly that suicide has a world to come, has a share in the world to come. But there's nothing like this explicitly, at least in the Gemara. So that's Rabbi Ashkenazi's. And you'll see in the new volume, the three volumes, that's what everyone's doing. Everyone's writing to him, asking him, do you know this? Do you know that? These sorts of people who know everything in their head, they're less valuable today than they used to, but they're still, you still, you're never going to find everything, even if you have access to all these great databases. Bekiyut is not as valuable as it used to be, because everyone can find sources. So now it's the question of what you do with the sources, and what about sources that can't be located on Otsar Chachma? And still, there's a skill. It's not a Chachma, but it's a skill to searching on Otsar Chachma. But to make no mistake about it, so Bekios is not the same. So when you see someone like Rav Vlad Yosef, who has his hand on anything, that's before you had Otsar HaChachma and all these things. If you know how Otsar HaChachma works, you can see certain writers today, and you know they're citing it from Otsar HaChachma. You know that all their bekiyos comes from the computer. It's like, what do they say? The ego is out. They put it in and it pops out. You pop in the thing and the information comes out. And sometimes you see they're citing from the incorrect sources because they're just citing it from the Otsar HaChachma. They don't know what they're citing. They're citing. I've seen some examples where they just cite from the title page without realizing what's on the inside. It's a different author, but real Bekiyot, not Otsar HaChachma Bekiyot, still has value. Now we've ended the section dealing with what I called Tikkun Sofrim, and we're picking up with Siman Kuf Kaf Hey 125, page 259, and this brings us to my very first academic article. I was taking a class in college on the Jews of Spain. The first time I ever read Yitzhak Baer's unbelievable works, The Jews of Christian Spain. But I don't know how I found out about this, but I started researching it and then I published it, the idea of the Cheirem on Spain. So what is this idea of a Cheirem on Spain? Well, there was a common belief that after the expulsion of Spain, the rabbis declared a Cheirem, a ban on return to Spain. The rabbis did say you can't go back to Spain, but that's because we have various takanot in communities, because when these Jews had left, they've gone, also Portugal, they've gone to, let's say, the Netherlands or Hamburg, or they were in England. What happened is that they were still doing business with Spain and they would return to Spain. And when they returned to Spain, they had to live as a Christian because they couldn't live as openly as Jewish, so they'd be executed. So obviously you couldn't allow people to go back, and there's all sorts of takanot that if you do return to Spain for like a year, you can't have an aliyah. It was crazy to go back to Spain. I mean, it was dangerous. You could be caught and killed, and there were people who were. But people for money would go back. But there never was a chayrim, a ban on going back to Spain. But this became an issue because at the end of the 19th century, Spain, Jewish community in Spain was existing already for a few decades and started growing. And then Jews who had to leave Germany before World War II, Spain was an option. And so people started talking about Spain. Are you allowed to go to Spain? Is there a halachic prohibition? It's amazing that all the Gedolim who've discussed this issue, starting Rav Kook, Rav Kook, Rav Herzog, you go through the list, all the chief rabbis, just, and then more modern ones because of my letter. And then after the Holocaust, there was also discussion for the simple reason that there were those who wanted to declare a ban. He said the rabbis should declare a ban on living in Germany, a cherem. And they said, just like the rabbis declared a ban on living in Spain, they should declare a ban on living in Germany. Rabbi Chiya Yaakov Weinberg was even asked, should we have a cherem on living in Germany? And he said, no, you can't make such a ban. People need parnassa. There's reasons to go. Rav Meshulam Roth, the Komavasser, was asked about this, and he discusses the cherem on Spain and says there was no cherem on Spain. And so that's why there was discussions on this. So I wrote an article. You can read about it in the journal Sefarad. Sefarad is a journal. It's been appearing since the 1940s, I believe, not in the 30s. I think it begins in the 40s, which is a journal of Judaic scholarship by Spanish scholars. Most of it is in Spanish. Some of it is in English. There was a chair from, I think it's 1915, of Jewish Studies, University of Madrid, Avraham A.S. Yehuda. Avraham, I think it's Shlomo, or maybe Shmuel Yehuda. Yehuda, he came from Jerusalem, a big scholar, Bible scholar, all sorts of interests. And he was in Spain, and he was a he had a chair there, a chair in Spain. He's a he came from Jerusalem, and he had good relations with the Arabs. He was. I think he was Baghdadi, I believe, or I'm not sure which community he was, but he thought that the Zionists messed everything up, that the Jews and the Arabs could have got along together. Chaim Weizmann wrote a book, Trial and Error. Yehuda wrote a reply, Dr. Weizmann's Errors on Trial. But Yehuda, he wrote a book on Egyptology, trying to show that you can see from the Torah the recognition of Egyptian civilization, which means that it had to have been written in Egyptian times, because you can't have a work written, let's say, 1,000 years later that has you have all these Egyptian words in let's say in Shmos, Egyptian terms and names, Pinchas, for instance, Merari, all the a lot of there's a lot of Egyptian stuff. Now this has to preserve authentic memory. Because otherwise, if you're writing it 1,000 years later, you couldn't have this. Yehuda's book, I didn't check if it's on Google. He has a whole book on Egyptology in the Torah, but he wrote on many areas. And he was in Spain. Incidentally, the expulsion order, the expulsion of the Jews of Spain was only officially lifted in December of 1968. Before that time, technically, and this is written in the expulsion order, which you can see online, Jews found in Spanish territory could be executed. And so, but Jews started returning. I mean, it had become a secular country. It didn't matter anymore, but technically it was on the books till 68. And it was only in 1986 that Spain establishes diplomatic relations with Israel. This is 38 years after the founding of the state and 3 years after the socialists assumed power. During Franco's time, they didn't have relations. Although Franco, well, there's suspicion that he might have. Franco's a well-known Syrian name, Sephardic name. He might have had some Jewish blood. It's not clear. There were Jews that were saved during his time as dictator. But turn off that sound. Okay, so my question was, though, is there such a concept of a cherem on Spain? And why did I knew halachically it's not relevant. Everyone who dealt with it shows no, of course there's no a cherem on Spain. And Rav Ovadia Yosef visited in 1977. There's no issue of visiting there or living there or anything. But I wanted to get more sources for my article, and I wanted to know what the current chief rabbis say. So I first wrote to Rav Mordechai Eliyahu. This was in 1987, so we're talking a long time ago. And where is he? First I wrote to Rav Mordechai Eliyahu. Here he is. The next person I wrote to, I'll just show you the picture now. That's Rav Avram Shapiro. He was also chief rabbi. He's there. He is with President Bush, number one. And that was my question. Is there a concept of a cherem on Spain? And the first reply from Rabbi Mordechai Yahu was that he says, I don't know anything about it other than what Rav Yitzchak Nissim. He was the chief rabbi, not the one directly before him, the one before that. Also a Baghdadi, Rav Yitzchak Nissim and Rav Ovadia Yosef and Rav Mordechai Yahu were all Baghdadis. And he says that we don't have anything explicitly written. He thinks that maybe there's a hint to it because the Mabit of Moshe Trani says that there's no Jews living in Aragon and we're sure none will come. And he says, well, this implies that they said that no one should return, which I did say, although it's not an official cherem, they did say, you shouldn't go back there. But Rav Mordechai Eliyahu says we don't have any real sources on it. And obviously, this doesn't apply if you visit there. We do trips to Spain. God willing, we'll return our trips to Spain. Those are some of our favorite trips. Spain, incidentally, also includes Barcelona, which in medieval times, that's not Sephardi. In Barcelona, where the Ramban is, that's Catalonia. That's Spain is Castile and Aragon, all the way in the north there, close to France. They even speak a different language up there. If you remember, was it 2 years ago? They had this revolt. They wanted to, but today we regard it all as after the expulsion, because they were expelled from everywhere. Sephardi then included everywhere. And the Rambam, he always, even though he's living in Egypt, he always regards himself as from Sephardi. So that's from Mordechai Elihu. Rav Avram Shapiro, through his secretary, he didn't write it personally. Like Rav Mordechai Eliyahu, his letter is personally and signed by him. It's just that the chief rabbi tells me to tell you that although it's explained in a number of books that dealt with the cherem on Spain, there's no source for this that there was such a cherem. And look, today there's a nice big Jewish community in Spain with Rabbanim and Chabad. Chabad just opened up last year, a year and a half ago. No, it's actually a year and a half ago. Yeah, a Chabad house in Girona. There's no Jews in Girona. There are no Jews. Well, I take that back. You never know. It could be Israelis or something. But there's no community in Girona, but you have a lot of tourists. And everyone goes to Girona because there's a big museum there about the Rambam. It's called the Nachmanides Museum. And it's the center of Jewish mysticism. So for all the tourists who come, they walk by, they'll see there's a Chabad house. So you go in and he says that there are Jews who live in like surrounding towns, a Jew here, a Jew there. There's always Israelis wherever you go. So like they'll have holiday services. But we had our lunch there in the Chabad house in Girona. But you're all invited to come. And I'll tell you something about Madrid, and then I'll share it with you next week. Actually, in Madrid, let me share it to you next week because I don't want to get off topic. I'll make a note of it. Something you can eat in Madrid that we can't eat in, well, until recently, you couldn't eat in America. So I'll get to that next week. I want to take you now to the next responsum, and this is Kuf Chav Zion. We're moving, we're getting along, we shall finish one day. Page 260, and it's to this rabbi, new figure. You are looking at Rabbi Chaim David Halevi. Halevi, Sephardic chief rabbi of Tel Aviv. Before that, as I recall, he was in Rishon LeZion. He's the author of many works, most famously, I don't know how many volumes, you have to check. It's called Aseilah HaRav. I say, well, these are responses that he wrote, but they were like simple, in simple language, without going into much, many pulling, but they were quite popular. He also wrote a volume called Mayim Chaim Tshuvot. He wrote like a Kitzur Shulchan Aruch of sorts. And he was an important person in the public, in religious public. He was a Mizrahi person, fascinating figure. He is the subject of a biography, actually, this work. By father and son team, Rabbi Mark Angel and Rabbi Chaim Angel, Rabbi Chaim David Halevi, gentle scholar and courageous thinker. As it says here in the description, he served as Sephardic Chief Rabbi of Tel Aviv, influenced by the profound and compassionate teachings of his mentor, Rabbi Ben-Zion Uziel. Rabbi Halevi represented the best in the Sephardic tradition of Judeo-Spanish Sfaradim. So what does that mean? Represented the best in the Spanish tradition. Well, as opposed to the worst. What I mean by the best is that he represented the old Sephardic mentality of tolerance, of openness to secular knowledge, to wide-ranging curriculum, to the poetry of Spain, to Parshanut, to the various commentators, to the Jewish thinkers, the Jewish philosophers, and also Kabbalah, but not Kabbalah in the sense of magic and these guys who go around who can read your palm and give you a bracha if you pay them. That. No, Kabbalah as a Jewish theosophy, as a repository of Jewish wisdom and moderation. Rav Chaim David Halevi, that's a theme in the book of the Sephardic rabbi of old, who the entire community went to him. Not everyone was so observant, but the rabbi understood that he's responsible for everyone in the community. So he was able to reach out in love to all members of the community, no matter what their level of religiosity. The opposite, I guess you could say, of Kanaut. So for Rabbi Mark Angel, if you know his own philosophy, obviously Rabbi Halevi would be someone that he would look up to and would be the model of Judaism that he would advocate. And that's indeed why they wrote the book. My question to Rav Chaim David Halevi was as follows, and this goes back to 1989. We were talking before about what is said about Leah. She went out dressed like a harlot. Well, that's not in the Chumash. You can find all sorts of examples. Most famous, I think, most people know this because you learn it early on. When you're a kid in school, it says Noach was a tzaddik in his generation. So what does that mean? The Gemara says, I believe it's right on Rashi as well. What does it mean? Some say that only in his generation he was a tzaddik. If he lived in another generation, his generation was so bad that anyone who's had it halfway decent is a tzaddik. If he lived in another generation, he wouldn't be any big deal. And the other opposing opinion is that no, he was a tzaddik in his generation, but had he lived in the generation of Avraham, then he would have been even a greater tzaddik because he would have been raised by his generation. But how can you say that it says he's a tzaddik? You say he's really not such a tzaddik. It's only because of his generation. A couple of weeks ago, we had the parsha. It says Yosef went in to do his work. You just read the pshat. He went in to do his work. If you look, one of the interpretations is he went in to go sin with Potiphar's wife. And you can find over and over again where Chazal read things in a negative way that if you look at the pshat, hey, if you look at the pshat, Bilam. Bilam doesn't look so bad. And what does Bilam do that's so bad? He says these wonderful things about the Jews. When the people come to him, he says he can't go with them to Balak. He has to sleep on it. And even Esav, for that matter, if you just read the pshat, Esav doesn't come out looking so bad. Although Esav's different because, as I've already said before, I think some of the midrashim that make Esav look so bad are not necessarily speak about Esav, but are really like Esav is the representative Edom for Rome or later Christian Empire, or maybe even as David Eisen reminded us a few weeks ago, maybe in response to what David said, even for Jesus. It could be that sometimes Bilam's mentioned, and really he's a stand-in for Jesus. But we have plenty of examples, and the Mekoshe Tzeitzim, the one who goes out and gathers on the Shabbos. So is that Tzlafchad? So someone says Tzlafchad, and the rabbis, and the response is, well, wait a second, the Torah didn't say this. So if you're right, it's Lashon Hara. If you're wrong, it's mostly Shema. So my question to Rabbi Halevi was, how do the sages offer these interpretations? Because if the Torah doesn't tell us this, why is this not, it's Lashon Hara. Well, I said Lashon Hara, but I mean, technically Lashon Hara doesn't apply, according to many at least, if someone's not alive, but it's defaming someone's character. It's another problem, even if it's not technically Lashon Hara. How can you speak bad, say bad things about it? If the Torah doesn't mention it, even if you think it's true, how do you have the right, how did the sages of old have the right or feel like it was important to offer these interpretations which make Leah, for instance, look bad? Isn't this wrong? I was asking. I mean, not that I'm criticizing Chazal. I want to know, how does this work? What's going on here? And he replies to me as follows. that everything we see in the interpretations of the sages, that refers to Gemara, Midrash, and I would say even, I guess, you get to Rishonim, because occasionally the Rishonim will even offer interpretations like this. He says, this is Amita Shel Torah. This is part of the of Torah. And he says the Torah wished, according to this understanding, the Torah wished that we would know that which the rabbis explained. In other words, when the rabbis are explaining it, it's not that you have Torah and then you have they're giving their interpretation, which makes them look bad. No. This is part of Torah. The Torah wishes us to have these understandings. So why? Well, you can give all sorts of reasons, because then we can understand why Esav is who he is, and we can understand why Yaakov responded that way. And we can explain all sorts of reasons why it's important for us to know this information. And of course, you have to explain why did the Torah tell us? And that you can also give explanations of why the Torah, there's all sorts of ways you can understand why the Torah didn't. It could be just sometimes I think the reason is because it's not meant for everyone. Getting back to this old issue, remember the story of it says that they wouldn't, well, they wouldn't read certain things. Well, I don't want to get into that, actually. It could be that certain explanations, maybe not everyone's supposed to know. I don't know. You can come up with all sorts of reasons. And he says, regarding what I said about Noah, was a tzaddik in his generation? He's saying that from the interpretation of the person who says it means he's only a tzaddik in his generation, this is the Torah saying it. It's not like you have the Torah and then you have an interpretation separately. No, this is what the Torah is saying. So by explaining it this way, you are revealing what the Torah wants you to know. So it's the question which I asked, well, how is this, this is revealing something extra that maybe wouldn't be better that we wouldn't reveal this? The answer is no, because the Torah dafka wants us to know this. And then, of course, we just need to explain, well, then why is the Torah written in a cryptic way? But that you can ask about everything in Torah Shabbat Peah. Everything we have, there's a reason why certain things are written explicitly and other things are only to be derived. I always assume that in matters like this, the Ikar is one, and the other is like a tolda. It's not necessary. It's not necessary to know whether Noah was a tzaddik only in his generation or in any generation. Torah says he's a tzaddik, so you can assume he's a tzaddik whenever he was. You don't need to know that. It's not an ikar. It's not essential to know that. But the Torah is telling you, according to that interpretation, that this is what it is. So if you're able to learn and go beyond the simple meaning, then you'll be initiated into that. And then he says, "There's chas v'shalom. This is not lashon hara." And he says, "Just this is no different than like the Torah writes about other people, like Lavan, Esav. Although Esav, as I said, he's much worse than Chazal. Lavan, Lavan's not a good character. Why does it write about Lavan? Of course, I don't think this is such a good answer, because Lavan's a rasha. So of course you can write lashon hara and say bad things about Lavan and Esav also." I was dafka speaking about people like Noah who are not portrayed that way, but Rabbi Halevi sees it as the same. He says that the Torah tells us these things either explicitly or giving it in a way that you're supposed to see it. And since the Torah is saying it, this isn't something separate. You can't ask why was it done. Although I mentioned in the case of of Tzofra, they do mention, but that's the sages asking that. And it says they tell the story of the eagle. And the spies, look, the spies, that's saying a bad thing. You could say, why does the Torah tell us about the spies? It makes them look bad. But the answer is because the Torah wants us to know certain truths. And he says, yeah, this is the explanation. Otherwise, you can't tell anything. He says it's, and for the bad people, he says it's a mitzvah to explain the bad things they did. And of course, you look in the sages, they don't just say about Torah figures, they say about other figures. And throughout history, this is it's a tension, which I don't know what the answer is, because on the one hand, you're not supposed to say bad things. On the other hand, we know you're supposed to expose the hypocrites. And if someone who we think is a pious person did something bad, we're supposed to let people know about it. So at the end of the day, it seems that there's confusion as to how far you're supposed to take this. Look, if you're writing a work of history, of course you're supposed to write what happened. And if one rabbi did a terrible thing to another rabbi, you don't have to write it. They write it themselves, the other rabbis. So the assumption seems to be that something done publicly, that it's important for people to know, it's okay to mention it. And I think the stories that we saw, the shocking stories about the rabbis criticizing other rabbis, is because the other rabbis are supposed to see this and learn from this. The Rav Levi ben Chabib, the Ralbach, he asks about, he has a response in which he wants to know about some of these stories that don't, that, you know, talks about certain rabbis who were given sexual temptations. And why would you tell a story like this? There's a famous story. A man traveled very far. His tzitzis saved him from sinning. And the Ralbach sees this as actually a praise. That you see that they were, today we wouldn't regard it as a praise. If anyone told a story like this, that a great gadol traveled far to the prostitute and only at the last minute was, we wouldn't think that that's praise. But the Ralbach thinks this as praise, these stories, because it shows that even the greatest people, they were able to overcome their inclinations. Rav Lichtenstein somewhere writes, he actually appreciates that approach because he says that if you look at the gadolim literature we have, you have nothing like Augustine's Confessions. Augustine wrote a work, an autobiographical work, in which he spoke about how, as a youth, what a sinner he was. Today, you can never have that because if you have a Baal Tshuva who becomes a great Torah sage, he'll never want to reveal how he was in his youth, and no one would ever write about it. In fact, they cover it up. Rabbi Wolbe, for instance, the famous Rabbi Wolbe, comes from a completely great Musar figure, but he came from a completely irreligious family. And yet, if you read the Haredi newspapers after he passed away, they make him seem like he was a Torah sage from his youth and this and that. He came, his father was an atheistic, atheist, they say, completely irreligious, certainly professor in Berlin. He came from an irreligious background entirely. And after this appeared, one of the obituaries, I think it was in the Jewish Tribune in London, someone wrote a piece in saying, why can't you tell the truth? This is a great mila for him that he grew up in this non-religious home and he was able to become religious. But in that world, they won't want to say this. So Rav Lichtenstein writes that we don't have anything like Augustine's Confessions, and he thinks that's a problem because look, we have Rabbi Akiva. We have what? Reish Lakish. The Gemara tells us about these people, so it shows that if you're eight, you shouldn't be ashamed of your past. Don't be ashamed of Rav Scheinberg and Rav Lichtenstein were never ashamed of the fact that they could tell you all the baseball players from the 1940s and 50s. They moved beyond that, but they weren't ashamed by it. And I know a certain rabbi who made believe in public, and he comes from that he didn't know who the Yankees were. Literally made believe he didn't know who the Yankees were. And this is someone who came from a non-religious background, believe it or not. But I mean, he felt like literally had to make believe that he didn't know who the Yankees were, that they were, he said, what, they're a baseball team or something? We don't need to make believe with that stuff. Oh, it's already 9:33. Let me take the questions and comments. Thank you, Mel, as always. Mel, you're not a yucky, but I appreciate it. Baruch says, congregational singing is the way I recall the expression. Rather than communal singing, right? Congregational, communal, they're all the same. This is really an American thing, the Young Israel movement. It used to be you'd sit and listen to the chazan. And whenever you're in those shuls that have the chazan, my sense is you're not supposed to do anything. You're supposed to sit and listen to the chazan. But the way we have it today, where we sing, if you go to Yeshiva Shminyonim, even for Ochadoti, who sings it? The chazan will sing it. Then you mumble, I guess. Between each little section there. You take the Torah out of the Ark, you don't say Bay. So this is important, and this is an American thing. It's not really traditional, but a lot of things in Europe, they didn't do it, but today we do it. That explains, incidentally, why there's been a backlash in one area against this. All of us here, I think, or at least people my age and older, we grew up in Hallel singing. Remember, we used to sing, we would sing it all together. Although really you're supposed, the Aruch HaShulchan sort of like, as I recall, justifies it, but you're really, it's supposed to be responsive. That's one of the achievements of Art Scroll, the Art Scroll Siddur. I remember how it took a while, but now if you start singing Yomar Na with the Chazan, someone will shush you. And really, Art Scroll's right. It's supposed to be responsive, but because we became a community where we sing together, and if you look, for example, on Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, the Machzor will tell you responsive, and yet we sing it all. We don't do it responsive. So I don't know really if there's any difference. We do a lot of things where they tell you responsive, but congregational singing is vital in the modern Orthodox synagogues. You need that. Susanna says, I don't get it. Learning to lane is a valuable skill. How would all the backyard minyanim function without multiple people who can lane? You're always going to have people who can lane. The question is, does every kid Need to lane. My friend wrote to me. I asked him about this just today. My friend in Lakewood, who his son did learn to lane. He says he gave the reason as to why. He says that in yeshivas they don't allow young boys to lane. They have an issue with the fact that many boys don't lane correctly or lane by heart or lane it by heart. In other words, not reading it. You're always going to have people who can lane. There's always, or generally, you'll have someone who can lane. The question is, does every kid need to lane? And often they don't do very well. Sometimes they make a lot of mistakes. Rav Nachum Rabanovich, he said that you don't need to correct the bar mitzvah boy because it's embarrassing to him, and the busha, the embarrassment to him is worse because there's shittas that you can, doesn't have to be perfect laning. So he thought that for a bar mitzvah boy, because there are sometimes you have the bar mitzvah and makes a lot of mistakes. So. Susanna says the Yemenite minhag is to lane your aliyah when you're called up. Well, that used to be everyone used to do that. The Yemenites will lane when before they're 13. They can lane at 7, 8 years old. They used to. So today you're saying they still. You can lane if you know it. I've told the story a number of times. Well, I did it a couple of weeks ago, more than a couple of weeks. Bereishis, because that's my son's bar mitzvah parsha, and I taught it to him. So they called me up for the mafter. So I said I can lane the laning the mafter also. But I told the story a number of times, and I still regret it. And since we have people from looking out in from Boston, this happened at Kadima Toras Moshe. So you could tell them once I was there for Shabbos visiting, and they it was parsha Zachor. And they gave me parshas. I was doing the haf. They gave me the mafter, and I told them that I could lane it, and I laned it, and I laned it perfectly. And how did I do that? Because it's I'm my parshas kisetsi, so I know parshas zachar. But later I felt guilty about this because they're probably thinking later that I'm like some expert. I know I can. They just call me up out of the blue. I didn't know I was getting mafter, and all of a sudden I can say I can lane it. They think I know every single Torah portion, which isn't true. All I know is kisetze and a few rishons that I've laned in my son's parshios. So I felt that afterwards that that was I didn't think of it till later, but I gave the wrong impression that I'm some Jeremy Weeder here who could just lane. We all know people who could lane the whole Torah. My neighbor growing up was the older man. My friend's grandfather would lane every week. He knew the entire Torah by heart. But that's not me. Baruch says, Midrash says Yaakov was 84 when he married. Yes, and some there's a Midrash that speaks about Leah as 22. But there's another source that speaks of Rachel as 13, I think Leah, sorry, as 13 or 14. I'll get back to drunk. You'll see. I'll show you next week. Sukim, I'll show you the Sifs Das Zakanim, and I'll show you the Sforno, and I'll show you an unbelievable parallel, which I think you'll find fascinating. Ellen says in the story of Dudaim, Leah and Rachel are portrayed negatively by the Midrash. I don't remember Rachel, okay, we'll get Baruch, save the drunkenness next week, and wait till you see what. I say, Howard says he davened in Moroccan family minyan and he received an aliyah and they could not understand why they didn't want to lane the portion of the aliyah I received. Well, they were then pretty learned because I'm in Moroccan shuls when we go to Morocco and there the people, the average person doesn't know how to lane. But if you know how to lane, certainly you should lane. When we were in Morocco in January, 1 year ago, they gave me an aliyah and he asked me, do I want to lane it? And I said, no, but I didn't know the laning. What am I supposed to do? But
Mark, if I can say the trip when we went to Morocco the summer before, when you stayed in the hotel and a bunch of you went to the shul. So that was in Israel. They were like a parsha ahead. You remember that whole thing? So they had a whole discussion. They said, okay, they were going to do also Balak. I think they did Chukat. And then they clapped on the table and they just called the guy. They pointed to one of the Moroccan people. He just came up like out of the blue and he just lamed the entire parsha without Aliyah's nothing. So even now in Morocco, the people know, at least some of them know how to lame without warning.
That's in Marrakesh, not in Casablanca. Casablanca,
right? That was Marrakesh, of course.
If you grow up doing the old Sephardic way, where you do each parsha with the Ta'amim, then it'll be much easier for you. someone asked me why my articles are not on academia. I haven't yet got a chance to do it. Barry says there was a conference on Jewish medical ethics and debate in Leila. Leila was the journal that was published by Jews College, like the English Torah journal in England, between Fred Rosner and Rabbi Jacobovitz, about speaking at this conference where Dr. Jacobovitz cited the Takanot of Hanover, Germany, that if someone returned to Spain, he could not receive an aliyah for a year. Very nice. So he did not want to speak in Germany. And for one day when Rajkovich spoke, conference moved outside Germany. That's actually mentioned, this not about the Hanover, but in his discussions with Michael Shashar, he mentions that he didn't want to go into Germany. And I believe it mentions that about the conference moving outside Germany. But today, Germany is the only community in Europe where Jewish population is growing. It's there's yeshivas there and there's communities. Jacobovitz himself, I mean, he comes from Germany, his family, his father was a Dayan there. It was much more, I guess, personal and close to him not to go there. And he didn't tell other people not to go there. There's Jews living there. I understand if people don't want to go. And we haven't had a Germany trip since the first two, but we would like to have another one because, as I've said before, if you're not going to go to all the places where they've killed the Jews, Germany just more recent, but they did it in England, they did it in France. They've done it all over, unfortunately. And Barry says that his mentor, Rabbi Mark Angel, introduced me to the writings of Rabbi Halevi, as he told me that you and Ashkenazi should understand the true Sephardic thinking. And really, it comes from Rabbi Uziel. Because Rav Uziel, who was in Salonika, he carried on this Sephardic approach of openness. I guess that's the term. And yes, Rabbi Kelman says Rabbi Halevi was the first major posek to say smoking is forbidden. And then later, many, many others. In fact, today, I don't know, do any real major posek say it is not forbidden? But making of a gadol was banned? No, I don't. Making of a gadol was banned because they told about the authentic stories, supposedly authentic, in which not all the rabbis came out looking so great. So this rabbi had a temper, and this rabbi, and Rabbi had negative feelings about someone else. Rabbi Kamenetsky, in the introduction, says that he thinks that we can respect these gadoli more if you see them who they were. Oh, Shmuley says in many yeshivas they sing Lecha Dodi. I did not know that every yeshiva I've ever been to, the chazan sings, and you're supposed to mumble the other paragraph. Okay, coming to the end. Rabbi, yes, Baruch reminds us that beginning tomorrow, Rabbi Kelman will mention it, the expert laner. I mean, he's not the only expert laner. There's other expert laners, but he's very, I like him very much, and he enunciates certain things that other people don't. And you can see him on YU Torah, Rabbi Jeremy Weider. He was the, if I'm not mistaken, the Israel Bible Contest winner, right? For world winner or something. Yes. And he's different than the other Rosh Yeshiva in that he has a much broader sense of certain aspects. So I encourage everyone. Okay, congregational singing in America was innovated by the Young Israel Movement to increase interest in davening for American-born youth. As I said, yes, we can thank the Young Israel Movement for this. In those days, the Young Israel Movement, though, they didn't want rabbis. They actually, Mordechai Kaplan, one of the founders of it, but they thought that rabbi, it's sort of like kibbutz dati in Israel, that the young generation, what do they need these rabbis for, these European type of rabbis? And they wanted to have shuls without rabbis. You wonder with all these COVID minyanim where they're running through it fast without the rabbis, all these people are telling me they like it. That's sort of like what the Young Israel was, that, you know, if you had a shiloh, you'd ask the rabbi, but they didn't want to actually daven every week with the rabbi, with the sermons and the this and the that. So we'll see whether when COVID's done, if people are so happy returning. I think it's a problem. Someone in my town was mentioning that they're worried that after this happens, people are going to continue their minyanim, but then it'll be like, then it's a problem because then you're making a break with the community. I believe it was the Young Israel, Susanna, where they began with the singing, but it's not, again, in Europe, you didn't have that. You had the chazonos. Did I lane Zecher with just a seri? So it's a good question you ask because what I did is as follows. It's become, I'm very attentive to this because it's my parsha. So growing up, whenever you laned Timche as Zecher Amalek, Timche as Zecher Amalek. You just repeated the four words. Chabad, by the way, only says the one word, Zecher, Zecher. Somehow in the last 20 years or so, it's become now that you have to repeat the whole pasuk. And if you don't repeat the whole pasuk, they'll tell you you have to repeat it. It's become the halacha, even though I know, I think for the Rav, actually, he in his minyan, you repeat the whole pasuk. But others, I think for Moshe and others, said, no, Dafke, you're not supposed to do the whole pasuk. You're just supposed to do Timchei HaZecher, Timchei HaZecher. I did just Timchei HaZecher, Timchei HaZecher. But later, I told Rabbi Helfinger that I don't believe you need to repeat it at all, because the Masorah in Europe was only to say Zecher, not Zecher, Zecher. Of course, the Sephardim only say Zecher, but they don't say distinguish Zecher and Zecher. It's all Zecher. But this is the influence of the Mishnah Berurah that we repeat it. In Europe, before the war, it was pretty uncommon. And if you go back 200 years ago, it was basically unheard of. But that's the Minhag. You can't argue with City Hall. So, but at least when you do Kiseitse, you don't repeat it. Only on Parsha Zohar.
In our shul, they repeat the whole three psukim. They don't.
I've never heard that before. Come on, you're pulling my leg.
I'm not pulling your leg. I'm not pulling your leg. They read the whole thing once with Zecher, once with Zecher. Okay. Yeah.
Well, that's what we call Tircha de Tzibura.
I agree.
By the way, and I'll end with this. So you take this. It's a. If you come on the Central Europe trip, you'll learn where this notion came from that women are obligated in Parsha Zohar, because women are not obligated in Parsha Zohar. It's not halacha. So it's a mitzvah sheshes man grama, or not a mitzvah sheshes man grama. It's connected to Mohammed, a war, and women, as it says, la b'nei Mohammed. They made a big joke a few years ago because, you know, the Haredim, who don't want to go to the army, were saying that we're not soldiers. We were in Torah. So the big joke going around was that they should be putter from Parsha Zohar, because they said we're not B'nai Mohammed. And that's the reason the Sefer Achinuch gives women are not obligated. But it's become the minhag for women to hear it. It goes back to Rav Nosson Adler, the great Rav Nosson Adler, we spoke about a few weeks, has now become very popular. Although Rav Menashe Klein goes off about it. He says, whoever heard of this in Europe? He thinks it's like feminist. But Rabbi Aaron Felder, who we spoke about, you saw me in a picture with him. He records in his Sefer, and he's a Talmud Milk of Ramosha, that Ramosha was very opposed to this practice of taking the Sefer Torah out after davening and reading it a second time for the women, because it's not a halacha. And, you know, if they're not there, we don't just take the Torah out stam. I really have to say, I don't understand this point of Ramosha, and the Rav didn't have an issue with it, because you're allowed to take a Torah out to read it. We take a Torah out for the Bar Mitzvah practice. You can take a Torah out to learn. So I don't see why Ramosha had an issue with this, that you couldn't take it out. Maybe because he thought it was like a sheker. You're implying that it is an obligation. But Ramosha did not believe in taking the Sefer Torah out to read for the women a second time, precisely because they're not, but that's not the minhag. Okay, and thank you. And just so end, Mel says that they do sing in Lakewood, in Essential, they do sing Lachadodi, but not Keladon. And yes, the conservative synagogues are very worried, because now you can live in Florida and still belong to your shul in New Jersey on Shabbos, because you can go by Zoom. That's going to be the real impact on the non-Orthodox synagogues. Okay.
They're going to be... mergers. I have a good friend that worked in the conservative shul. He said lots conservative shuls will be merging. Anyways, yeah, lots of changes coming. Hopefully we'll get there soon. Let's get there first, please God, soon. But anyways, thank you. Tomorrow night, Jeremy Weir is the third of our three shirim tomorrow. It's not a shir had a lane, of course. I think people understand it's a shir and how the Tameh HaMikra, how the laning helps us understand the pshat and how the tamim developed, etc. You can see on the website, I'm sending out an email later, the five classes, each one is going to have a specific topic on Tameh HaMikra. So I do encourage you to come. For people who are Balei Kriya, they should for sure come, but it's of interest to everybody, I think, and it's an important topic, and it's an understudied, you know, topic. The people don't know, well, why, what does Pesukim mean, and like, how does the Parshanut of a Pasuk, or how does the Tamim actually help us in the Parshanut? So that's tomorrow night, 8 p.m., 8 o'clock. Going backwards, Benny Gesundheit, of course, is 17th of 30 classes in Sefer Tehillim at 12:15. And 11 o'clock, we start a four-part series, just our first of the two series we're starting tomorrow. Daniel Schwartz, Modern Anti-Semitism and the Study of Ancient Judaism. He's a professor at Hebrew U, an expert in this ancient Judaism. And so that's a four-part series starting tomorrow at 11. We got a triple header, and then we have another triple header on Wednesday and that double header on Thursday. So I do know about baseball, and I'm not embarrassed. I know who the Yankees are. I know the Blue Jays are, and all kinds of things I know. And when I was a little kid, my father would say, if I knew sports, if I knew the Gemara like I knew sports, I'd be a big Talmud Chacham.
Well, let me just say, and for whoever's going to put this on YouTube, you keep it on. Don't cut off this.
Oh, I shouldn't.
One of the greatest things to listen to, if you want, it's his greatest ever done. I think there's probably a link on the Wikipedia. Rabbi Aaron Rakefetz, yes. Hesped for Joe DiMaggio. Right. I think it's in two parts. If you haven't heard it, you can even speed it up on YouTube if you want. It is classic. What Torah lessons you can learn from the great Joe DiMaggio. And it's Rabbi Aaron Rakefet, who's my teacher, at his best. The Hesped for Joe DiMaggio.
He said many times, I heard him say, he taught me also when I was in the Gris Kollel. Rabbi Rakefet said this is by far his most popular shiur that he's ever given. And I, one thing that's, there's a lot that sticks out from that year, but one thing, if I can say, playing baseball, it's, to me, it's mind-boggling. DiMaggio played for all these years. He said he was never thrown out going first to third on a single, never thrown out a third base in his career. That's like Gavaldic. Like if you know baseball, that's like, a, you know, that's amazing. You know, besides this 56 game hitting streak, okay, now you got me wound up. I'm sorry. But anyways, the great Joe DiMaggio, what can we say? Laila Tov, let's learn Torah, baseball. This is Tafel, but it's, you know, it's
well, Mordechai Elephant in his memoir, which I'm going to be writing about, he speaks about Joe DiMaggio. So I'm not a baseball fan. I don't know any much about it. But okay, good night.
Okay.